thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out. Do thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Labor Radio? I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Joining me, as always,
Elliot Gilliland.
Thanks for being here, Lee.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a big episode for us this week.
Yes, indeed. We are coming to you from the beautiful KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. Tonight, we are going to be diving into the newest trade deal that the U.S., Mexico, and Canada have all signed. It is called the USMCA, or the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, and it is a replacement, essentially, for the 1990s-era NAFTA trade deal, the North American Free Trade Act. It's being referred to as, you know, basically NAFTA 2.0, but there are some differences, some major differences, and, you know, as we'll go into, there are some improvements and some areas that it has moved away from the previous impacts of NAFTA. So we'll be discussing that, and if we have time, we will be discussing some issues at the Amazon fulfillment centers, but we'll see if we get to that. Anyways, very recently, within the past few weeks, the U.S. Congress, headed by Nancy Pelosi, passed the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, which replaces the 25-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, otherwise known as NAFTA. Upon the deal's agreement, Nancy Pelosi said, "There's no question, of course, that this trade agreement is much better than NAFTA, and it is definitely or indefinitely better than what was initially proposed by the Trump administration." For his part, Trump expressed his support for the new agreement, tweeting, It will be the best and most important trade deal ever by the USA. Good for everybody. Capital farmers, capital manufacturers, energy unions. Tremendous support. Importantly, we will finally end our, for some reason, capitalized country's worst trade deal, NAFTA! Exclamation point. I don't really know how to read a Trump tweet exactly.
Yeah, no, I think you did about the best you could there. And again, it's a tweet where maybe not all of it is super accurate, but we'll get into that.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, a lot of random capitalizations and underlines. But anyways, I digress. The deal aims to nudge manufacturing back into the U.S. and Canada as well. It includes a requirement that 40% to 45% of cars eventually be made in countries that pay auto workers at least $16 an hour, which essentially means the U.S. and Canada, because there are only three countries in the deal. And to qualify for zero tariffs, so for essentially free trade, the cars that cross the border would have to be 75% made in North America, up from 62.5% under NAFTA. So that does, in fact, bolster the U.S. North American countries' car manufacturing, of which the U.S. is the biggest in that industry. The big question there, though, you know, is there's a lot of politics around this, and we'll get into it. But the real question is this a win or is this a loss for American workers?
Yeah, and I think that's a really big question that's facing a ton of people. And I think, honestly, if there was a subtitle for this episode, it would be internal division, because I think not everyone's really sure. When you're talking about free trade and kind of globalization, outside of the scope of labor somewhat, though, you know, it does obviously apply. But I think one of the biggest things that we're facing here is enforcement. When you're talking about a free trade deal like this or NAFTA, enforcement has obviously been one of the, you know, hardest and biggest sticking points. So I think that's something to really keep an eye on. And a lot of the major kind of opposition to this, especially from the Democratic side, has been a lack of that exactly. So there's kind of a lack of enforcement and also kind of a lack of just overall foresight of how this is going to go down. For example, I know that an earlier version of this, Mexico, basically, it was in there that Mexico would have to allow American inspectors to basically be allowed to come in to make sure that kind of some new minimum wage and just kind of other laws like that are being followed. And they basically rejected that, and that did not make it in the final.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, yeah, there is a decent amount that is unknown. And I think one important thing to note, too, is at this point, this is just a handshake deal.
Right.
So this is not legislation. And at a certain point, when it does come back, it's possible that it could change.
Yeah.
And it is possible that, you know, the stuff that Democrats fought for right now, when it comes back around, they don't. It is important to note that that probably won't happen just because, you know, Mexico and Canada are involved and they have to sign off on all the changes.
Right.
So that makes it really difficult. But it is, I think, important enough to note that this is just at this point a handshake deal with Trump that mm-hmm. does not exist yet.
Right. And it is still yet to fully pass Congress at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still has to be voted on the floor. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's a lot of different considerations that go into it. Ultimately, as we mentioned earlier, there are definitely some improvements for, you know, working conditions and standards for workers and pay and things like that.
Yeah. And kind of bringing the NAFTA, a 90s, you know, act,
right.
Like you said, kind of into the new age. So the deal also does a lot to include, like basically stopping increasing the free flow of digital information across borders. So, you know, countries can't kind of require companies to store data locally or, you know, kind of put tariffs on digital products or different things like that. So, you know, a company like Netflix, this is a really big deal for.
Oh, of course.
Because they basically can't do the same sorts of physical tariffs that they would on digital products.
Yeah, how exactly would you really do that?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, along the lines of enforcement, like I was talking about earlier, I think another really big boon here is kind of investor state dispute settlements. So this is kind of a not well known thing, but basically ISDS is, like I said, an investor state dispute settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what this is it basically means that when there are kind of grievances between a foreign investor and a, you know, a domestic state, basically previously NAFTA would allow those foreign investors to settle those disputes through arbitration with mm-hmm. the state as opposed to their local domestic courts. And that led to a little bit of abuse. So, you know, if someone was trying to invest in something and it didn't quite go the way they planned, they could kind of, you know, get into arbitration with the state that they were working in and usually get some money out of it. And we saw a huge spike of this in the late 90s and kind of through the 2000s and 2010s. And so I think a really big thing here that the Democrats did get was exactly that. They basically removed that arbitration in most cases. There are some where it's still allowed, and also in some countries it gets a little complicated, but Canada basically has completely turned those off. It really enables them to kind of deal with things on a more domestic level in their actual court system as opposed to this separate arbitration.
Right. I mean, that does seem more fair. Like, one of the major complaints, and we saw this as well over the past few years with the negotiation around the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the big complaints that you know, municipalities and workers had in general was that it was balanced too heavily towards the investors or, you know, the corporations that were involved in the deal. And a lot of power was taken away from the municipalities and the localities and the people on the ground. So that is interesting that they have sort of rebalanced that slightly. It's also interesting that, you know, kind of like we mentioned earlier, this is basically just an update of NAFTA in a way. And what you mentioned about particularly like the digital companies that do exist. Ooh. And anyways,
yeah.
Sorry about that, technical difficulties. But one of the things that's interesting about the update of it is that it does, you know, I would imagine that lobbyists and you know, representatives from these big companies like, you know, Netflix and all the streaming companies, as well as Google and Facebook, like all of that has really ramped up, and I'm sure it's been a big part of the negotiating process for this deal. Whereas, you know, when the original NAFTA was signed in 1994, that was a much smaller share of the economy and a much smaller part of the picture. Mm-hmm. And so they really did have to update those rules. So that is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. You know, looking online too, you'll probably see a lot of information around a bit healthcare too. There was a lot of protections kind of built in internally for kind of drugs and things like that, which also got removed, which I think is also a really good thing that, that the Dems snuck in there. So again, I think internal divisions is going to be the as we jump into the politics of this, you know, there's a little bit more of the news story there, but I think that's really going to be, there's some marginal improvements on the NAFTA deal, but overall it has some weird timing to it and a little bit of discord between kind of two different halves of the Democratic Party.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's a basic rundown of the nitty-gritty of the basic facts of the deal. And now, you know, we'll move on to the part that is slightly more, not important, but slightly more relevant to, you know, most American workers and listeners in general.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, of course, the domestic politics of it. So obviously, this is a, you know, anyone who was around in 2016 remembers that Donald Trump campaigned, one of the major things that he did campaign on was how bad NAFTA was and basically getting into the White House and repealing bad trade deals. And so in doing this, you know, there's a big question that's floating around that is basically like, did the Democrats just hand Trump a major victory amidst the impeachment hearings and just before a major presidential election year?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And, you know, like I said at the top, I have a feeling this is kind of going to get a lot more political than we normally get on the show, because that's where the kind of the meat of this story is. And, you know, previously we talked about the Chicago Teachers Union and other and others kind of winning key sustainable victories for their members and communities at large. But I'm not really so sure that this deal was all about long-term success of labor or even trade. It seems as though the Democratic Party, to me, has decided that by making bipartisan agreements before 2020 is like a really important objective for them.
Yeah,
it seems like they've kind of just declared this as an objective.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether that's to help win purple districts or combat the do-nothing Democrats rhetoric coming from Trump and especially his base. But when you combine that with the AFL-CIO and the corporate Democrats, I think this deal was basically inevitable.
Right.
Once the AFL-CIO put its stamp of approval on it, even the really hardcore labor Democrats just flipped for it.
Yeah.
So that really, once that happened, it was the final nail. And so, you know, both the AFL-CIO and big corporations are key fundraisers for a lot of the right-leaning Dems that are in Nancy's caucus. And so, you know, by doing this, they can kind of provide more certainty to the businesses in their districts that depend on the current pact, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of uncertainty of when it was going to end and what it was going to look like. And it also helps them create more jobs right before 2020. So it's kind of it's an interesting political decision, I think, as opposed to a trade one.
Right.
I'd still like to point out, though, that the Dems did get some key concessions in the deal, which we talked about. And you kind of can't really argue that there were marginal improvements over NAFTA. It just kind of wasn't exactly what we wanted.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, the question I saw online the most is, should you do a deal with Trump, even if that deal is only marginally better? And I don't know if I really have an answer for that. In reality, the you know, the USMCA is going to create around 50,000 jobs by most estimates that I saw.
Yeah, me too.
And that's, you know, really not, in the grand scheme of things, very large. It's relatively a small amount.
Yeah, especially when you consider that NAFTA lost something like over 600,000 jobs.
Yeah.
When that was first put in place. So this is a drop in the bucket compared to that.
Yeah. And then while this is happening, Trump basically gets to, you know, for no better phrase, but he gets to trumpet the victory in campaign ads across the country and potentially win some additional districts like next year. And so that's kind of strange. Like, the timing and narrative around the deal from the Dems just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Even if you buy kind of Nancy Pelosi's bipartisanship strategy, most economists agree that this deal is very similar to NAFTA. And it seems strange for her to declare the deal a win for America's workers.
Yeah, I mean, it is a strange claim, especially because it did come, I mean, like, the weirdest element of timing on this is that it came on the exact same morning. You know, they announced that this deal was going to get done. It had passed through the committee and it was going to be brought to the floor. They announced that the exact same morning that House Democrats also announced that they were bringing impeachment charges against Trump.
Yeah.
So it seems to, you know, on the one hand, the Democrats stepped out and said, you know, this man is unfit for office, and he is wholly corrupt and does not deserve to be, you know, holding that position anymore, does not deserve to be worked with. And then on the other hand, they turn around and say, but we did just work with him and give him essentially a trade deal that not only was a major campaign plank for him, but is also something that he can campaign on heading into the 2020 election. And, you know, one thing that we do see that, you know, has been the case around a lot of the rhetoric that has happened over the last 3.5 years, but one thing that's really interesting is that this essentially allows the Republicans, because of the timing of this and because that it is something that they the Democrats are not shying away from the fact that they're saying we worked with Trump, we found a bipartisan deal.
Yeah.
Because the Republicans don't care about decorum, they are essentially muddying the waters on this and saying, well, look, I mean, Mike Pence even tweeted out, he said, like, thanks to the strong leadership of President Trump and the efforts of our administration over the last year, Speaker Pelosi and congressional Democrats have finally acquiesced to the voice of the American people and have agreed to allow a vote on the USMCA. Yeah. So, I mean, the wording of that is they're basically claiming victory, and they're muddying the waters for folks who may be tuning in now to understand, all right, what is this impeachment? You know, where do I lean? You know, folks who may be undecided voters.
I live in the middle of the United States and I work at a car manufacturing plant. What does this mean
this
for me? Trump
for me,
kept my job.
Right.
I think it's very strange for Pelosi and kind of the House Dems to kind of put the narrative in Trump's hands and go, he'll speak good about us.
Right.
It seems like that's kind of what's happening. Yeah. So it's really strange. Like, When I'm trying to figure this out from Nancy's point of view, it seems to me that this was a deal that helped her keep control of her caucus and win some key concessions, you know, that actually a lot of Democrats and labor people have wanted for a really long time.
Right.
And I think that, like I said at the top, I think the deal was pretty much inevitable. And so I don't, you know, regardless of if you think the deal is good or bad, I think Nancy got some key concessions and that is good. I just feel like the narrative coming out of it was strange. If she had said instead, right, hey, we made Trump come to the table and be reasonable, and in the process we helped workers, let's keep the victories going.
Yeah.
That is so different to me than this is now, you know, a victory for America's workers, and, you know, look at how bipartisan we are. It seems very strange.
I know,
2018, I think there's some kind of disagreement on what happened in 2018. First of all, in the Senate, the Republicans picked up seats.
Right.
So, yeah, we did really well in the House, but we didn't just dominate. And I think that, you know, when you think about the Democratic Party, people came out to vote against Trump.
Yes.
Not to kind of vote for, you know, the clearest head. I think
it was, save for a few cases.
Yeah, the narrative wasn't, hey, let's, you know, even if Trump is making, you know, even if we disagree with Trump, let's come in and make a deal if it's a smart deal, which I actually do think I agree with. I think the narrative was more come out and vote against Trump. So it seems weird that this is the narrative that the Dems are kind of going with to try to, you know, get a boost going into next year.
Right, like heading into the impeachment. It seems strange that the Democrats, especially after 2016, but, you know, and after everything that we've seen over the last few years, and even from the Obama administration, the Obama era, that they've chosen as the hill to die on this bipartisanship. It really is confusing, because it's never reciprocal on the other side. The Republicans take their ground and they stand it, and they basically lob bombs at the Democrats. The Democrats, you know, ask for forgiveness or try and find some sort of common ground, and it just doesn't seem to work. It doesn't capture the American people's imagination. It doesn't really get them fired up to go, especially heading into an election that is potentially one of the most consequential. I mean, if you roll into it, what could happen with climate change and all those things, if we allow the Republicans to continue controlling, could be the most consequential election that we will ever see in our lifetime.
And we didn't really talk about it, but this deal actually isn't very green friendly.
No, that's
another
thing.
And so a lot of the stuff we've been talking about has been kind of different unions looking really far ahead and getting concessions for not only wages and kind of things we talk about every day on the show, but things that are just better for the community at large.
Yes.
And, you know, this is a deal, like I kind of said, you know, whether or not you agree or disagree with it, it's not really doing that. And I, you know, I would have expected the Democrats to come out and say, hey, this, you know, this was going to happen. We got some good concessions, but here's all the stuff we didn't get that we wanted.
We
want
to keep pushing.
And I haven't seen that at all. And so I'm really surprised by that, because, you know, I'm sure there was lots on the table that they wanted that they gave up on, and there was a ton they got. So to just not bring it up at all seems strange.
Yeah, and one of the major elements of union support for this deal, and in fact, you know, one of the major reasons it was able to get done was that the AFL-CIO, and particularly Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, he came out and endorsed it after, you know, meeting with House Democrats and Republicans and even speaking with Trump directly on the phone. He came out and endorsed this bill. And one of the things that's notable about the AFL-CIO and Trumka in particular is that, you know, he was vocally anti-Trump for a while, but his union has also come out, you know, they came out in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline because of the jobs that it would create, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
And they have come out ostensibly against the Green New Deal.
Yes.
Which if we're talking about looking into the future and what this does for the long-term vision and the health of this country, it is interesting that one of the major union supports for this is a group that doesn't seem to have that long-term vision in mind, because they are thinking in the short term of like what is going to be best for my members in terms of the jobs that exist now, and not thinking, you know, especially if you think through the Green New Deal, like what are the jobs that could be potentially available?
Yeah, renewable. It would be a whole new industry. So, yeah. I mean, not a new industry, but it would be an expansive growth for a current industry.
Yeah, curtail oil infrastructure jobs, and you ramp up green, you know, renewable technology jobs, and those would still go to the AFL-CIO member unions.
Yeah.
So that is an interesting element of this.
The whole thing seems like it's being used by multiple people for their own kind of optics,
yes,
as opposed to the deal itself. So
and the optics are so confusing on some people's part. You know,
yeah.
it is a really puzzling situation.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, like we said, it at this point it's a handshake agreement.
Right.
I think it goes to the floor on actually Thursday.
Yeah, I believe so. And that's of December. I believe it'll be December
19th.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
So I think. I think it's important for, you know, kind of everyone to keep an eye on it and see what's going on. And eventually, I think more things will bubble to the surface and things will make more sense for us once we know.
Absolutely. If you are just tuning in and listening to us now, this is Labor Radio, and we are discussing the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the new NAFTA deal, the trade deal, essentially. And just moving on from this slightly, you know, we're discussing how it's a deal that is ultimately better than NAFTA, but it's just the politics of it are questionable. Something that kind of goes hand in hand with that is the fact that the Democrats, and particularly Nancy Pelosi, worked so hard to get this passed, this trade deal passed, while at the same time, they've completely dragged their feet, or just actually entirely stalled on the process of moving forward a extremely pro-worker, pro-organized labor bill in the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking, of course, about the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or the PRO Act.
Yep.
And this is something that has, you know, this was introduced in May of 2019, and the PRO Act would make it easier for workers to join unions, eliminate right to work laws, impose new penalties on employers who retaliate against unionization efforts, crack down on employee misclassification, and establish new rules so that employers cannot delay negotiation of collective bargaining contracts. It already passed the House Committee on Education and Labor back in September, on September 25th, and it has 215 co-sponsors in the House and 40 in the Senate, largely along, or almost entirely along, party lines, of course. But just interestingly, Nancy Pelosi has still yet to bring this bill to the House floor, and she hasn't even given any indication of at what point she plans to do so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Yeah.
Right.
I think from kind of a labor point of view, this is the, I think, more interesting thing, because it's would basically stop a ton of terrible tactics used to stop workers from organizing. It's a lot of low-hanging fruit of things that, you know, they ought not to do and are just able to right now. So I think you hit it on the head with a ton of the, you know, I think especially misclassifying employees as supervisors or even independent contractors when they aren't.
Right.
You know, if you're working 40 hours or they just make you work just under that to classify you as a contractor, to remove you from all these, right? That's the kind of thing that the PRO Act is looking at. And, you know, instead of wasting time and money on union busting activities, it's funny, like employers should probably just prioritize partnering with workers collaboratively instead. And yet instead, you know, we have to create laws like this where we're going to stop all the really low hanging fruit of like bullying, basically. Because I think one of the stipulations in there was that employers could no longer force workers to attend anti-union meetings,
right,
where they would essentially bully them before a vote or do different things.
Like scare them, essentially.
Yeah, scare them. Yeah, and I think, and again, it would also kind of keep the right to work, kind of all that really, you know, we talk about muddied waters, but, you know, all the right to work stuff, you know, where you see the think pieces on, you know, giving people the right to, you know, actively not, you know, pay into a union, even though it's the thing that's getting them all the rights that they've gotten over the last 50 years.
Yeah.
And even, you know, as unions have shrunk, we've seen and we've talked about, you know, that inequality is now at basically its highest point in over 50 years. And the federal minimum wage is not rising. You know, from 1980 to 2014, the wages for bottom half of workers only grew 1%, while wages for the top 1% grew by 250%.
Yeah.
So if any, you know, I think I see a lot of, you know, unions are too powerful, things like this. If they're too powerful,
it's
I'm having trouble.
Yeah,
yeah. So I think from kind of a pure labor standpoint, this is one that I would really hope would see a ton of views and kind of get the same national attention that the, you know, the new NAFTA agreement has gotten.
Exactly.
But it's not.
No, it really isn't. And, you know, aside from a few articles about it here and there, it's largely died, faded away from public consciousness, too. I mean, obviously, you know, members of Congress and labor activists are still aware of it. And, you know, people like Progressive Caucus co-chair Representative Pramila Jayapal have been pushing Nancy Pelosi and you know, House leadership to bring it back to the floor. But, you know, people have actually been pushing to have it brought back to the floor before the end of 2019.
Mm-hmm. The sheer number of co-sponsors is like so
nuts.
Large, it's a little strange that we're not seeing it.
Yeah, especially like Representative Jayapal said, I don't know exactly what the holdup is, but it's taking longer than it should given the number of co-sponsors we have.
Mm-hmm.
Many other bills have come to the floor with fewer co-sponsors than this one has had.
Yeah,
And that's, you know, it's absolutely true. And it's a real shame, but it's also kind of an indication, because one of the things that's really interesting, beginning the fall when the impeachment process began, the Democrats, or, you know, specifically Nancy Pelosi again, one of the things that she came out and said was essentially like, we are curtailing a lot of, we're not going to be pushing for a robust legislative agenda because we are focusing on
impeachment.
But then to have this be, you know, to have the U.S. Mexico Canada trade deal be a thing that they came out with exactly on that same day as the impeachment proceedings, and then still stall a thing that would be far better for workers. It's pretty clear where the priorities are, and it leaves a lot of questions up in the air, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think when you look at it, you compare the two. One is basically a free trade agreement that, you know, does bring jobs back but lowers kind of overall costs for corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I'm an employer and I don't understand that this isn't kind of a who gets more of the pie, it's make the pie bigger.
Yes.
Right. So when I'm thinking of it as a win-loss scenario, something like the PRO Act really scares me, because I'm basically in my head being forced to, you know, do something that is not going to be good for my business. Whereas, you know, even if I bring jobs back to America, you know, through something like the new NAFTA agreement, I'm gaining kind of, you know, less tariffs and free trade and different things like that. So it's, I think when something is really actively trying to help the workers, like the PRO Act, that's why you see it get stalled out, is because it's a lot easier to point out as a corporation why I wouldn't want to do it.
Right. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is vehemently against it. They've come out against it on a number of occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is. It's specifically to help workers, and far less concessions are made for, you know, ownership, management, and those are the people who largely pay the bills within our Congress, in our political system. There's a lot more information that we could absolutely get into here, but I would say that I think that the American public's appetite is ready for something like the PRO Act. You know, we've seen a lot of strikes from teachers to, you know, people working in media and all these other places. And according to a Gallup poll, 64% of Americans approve of unions, up 16 points from 2009. So it's approval for unions, sentiment for unions is the highest point it's been in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we are going to have to leave it there. We will continue this discussion next time we are on the air. Thank you for listening to Labor Radio. Elliot, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, I am Michael Cathcart, and we will be back next month. If you want to continue this conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Michael B. Cath. Have a great night.
Yeah.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
They didn't decide how they can protect the animals or the environment or people more. Instead, they were like, well, how can we protect ourselves? And from that, they developed these protocols where prior to any large storm event, they're actually now locking all animals inside, boarding up the facilities and bolt locking them with multiple different devices so that nobody can get in and nobody can get out.
You were just listening to Elizabeth Jones, also known as Ethically Elizabeth. She is an animal rights activist, a rescuer, marine biologist, and a conservationist. You can catch this episode of Voices for the Animals on December 27th at 10 a.m. right here on KBOO, or anytime after the 27th on kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals, also on Google Play and iTunes.
Baby, you understand me now.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We are here with Amy Sitars with the Bronze Shoes Installation Project in PDX Sanctuary Movement.